Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with an old friend, Walter Truitt Anderson. Walt Anderson is the author of many books, including The Future of the Self and Evolution Isn't What It Used to Be, and most recently, The Next Enlightenment, Integrating East and West in a New Vision of Human Evolution. Welcome, Walt.
Hi.
You've been interested for many years in Buddhism and Eastern religion. Do you keep up a regular meditation practice?
I'd say basically no. I went through a period of doing quite a bit of study at the Tibetan Buddhist Center here in Berkeley and wrote a book about Tibetan Buddhism. But basically, I think of myself as being outside all of those traditions and trying to get at the subject matter, sort of coming at it from the West. What I say to people is that if we could just kind of imagine that there had never been Buddhism or Sufism or any of that Eastern stuff, how would we think about some of the experiences and understandings that people have in the course of their own psychological development? And what kind of an understanding can we develop from a Western point of view that allows us to think beyond just kind of ordinary everyday consciousness and ordinary everyday ego identity?
And in your book, you're exploring things that you've explored in other books as well, the various kinds of intellectual and sociological trends in Western thought that have led to a convergence with Buddhism. Is that the basic thrust of it, that there are many ways in which our contemporary zeitgeist is kind of contributing to a kind of Western Buddhist enlightenment?
Yeah, exactly. And we don't exactly start from zero when we start to try to think about some of the things that I just described. We have a rich tradition going through many, many themes of Western philosophy that give us a different perspective on human evolution and human consciousness. And so part of what I try to do in the book is to survey some of those in evolutionary theory and existential philosophy and psychotherapy, some of those themes that are taking us in the same direction. And I think that's one of the reasons that so many people are kind of open now to thinking about the ideas that we tend to associate with the East, which is that we have a pretty good platform in Western thought for doing that. It's not totally exotic.
Now, let's go through some of these intellectual trends. I mean, you start with the European Enlightenment. Well, what are some of the convergences or ways in which European Enlightenment thought has opened us up or prepared us for some of the insights of Eastern religion?
Yeah, well, in that chapter on the European Enlightenment, I mentioned the two, kind of superstars of the European Enlightenment, Hume and Immanuel Kant. And each of those, in different ways, raised some pretty far-out ideas that we generally don't associate with the Enlightenment. We think of it as all, just scientific rationalism. But it was also that profound radical empiricism of Hume, who was ready to take a look at anything. And he took a look at the idea of self and said, wait a minute, what do we find in our own experience that gives us the idea of a permanent identity that carries through, is that perhaps not, in a sense, an illusion? And that's a radical idea contained in a kind of good old-fashioned Scottish empiricist. And then you have Immanuel Kant talking about how do we deal with knowing, how do we deal with scientific knowledge, and how do we deal with the fact that everything we know about the outside world is, in a sense, contained in our own minds. And so he made the distinction between phenomena and noumena, And those are kind of awkward words. I feel almost embarrassed to be dragging him into a 21st century conversation. But he said, we never really know the universe. We know about our ways of knowing it. We know phenomena. We know phenomena that are rooted in human consciousness and in a sense, the human brain. And that offered a way of building a bridge between these arguments that people kill each other about is, you know, is science really tell us about the universe? Can we say that it's true, or is it all just imagination? And he said, yes, it is grounded, and we can judge it in a lot of ways, and we need to take science very seriously, but we also need to understand that it's still a human point of view through which we understand the universe. And he can't like to speculate about beings on other planets, you know, and he said that other species might understand the universe in entirely different ways, which doesn't mean that our understanding is wrong or useless. It's just rooted in human consciousness.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Kant, because of all the trends that we're going to talk about, that you talk about in your book, I think one of the things that a traditional Buddhist teacher might say about this argument that you make is that, yes, there are many ways in which Buddhist psychology and Buddhist epistemology have been prefigured in Western thought. But the thing that is missing in Western thought is some connection to a set of moral precepts and a way of living your life and a proactive mission to save other beings from suffering, and that there isn't that clearly articulated in existentialism or psychoanalysis, that kind of moral mission. Whereas in Kant, there is that connection, but perhaps there's not, even in his own thought, there's not that strong connection between his epistemology and his morality.
Well, I think there is a fairly strong moral thrust in Kant. But to come back to the Buddhist point of view, I think that in a sense, even though you have this kind of, you might call it the kind of official Buddhism with a lot of moral precepts and so forth, my understanding of that kind of psychological development is not so much that not so much of the thou shalt not point of view, but rather stressing that the psychological development takes people to a place where the morality then, so to speak, comes naturally, because it flows directly out of their way of understanding who they are and how they relate to the universe. And that, again, comes very, very close to what you find in contemporary moral development theory, where people are saying that as people grow and develop, they continually reconstruct their understanding of themselves and of their relationship to the world, and that those reconstructions just lead inevitably to different ways of moral behavior in the world, different kinds of moral principles. I'm sure you're familiar with that body of work.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, you also talk about psychoanalysis as a strain of thought, and you know, one of the things that I know that a lot of Buddhists have actually been self-critical about is the way in which Buddhist thought or Buddhist practice has been influenced by psychoanalytic models. I mean, every culture has, like when Buddhism went into China, it was influenced by Taoism and reinterpreted in terms of Taoist terms and ideas. And some people think that the reinterpretation of Buddhism as a form of psychoanalysis has been problematic because, it seems like pretty basic distinction between a talk therapy and a non-talk therapy, basically.
Yeah. A lot of these things, it's hard to really speak with complete accuracy about those kinds of issues, because a lot of times what you find written down in theory isn't quite the same as what happens, for example, to people in therapy and in psychoanalysis. And in the chapter, I talked a bit about the research of Finn Garrett some years ago, which was one of the things that really turned me in the direction of looking more closely at Eastern thought, where he said he just set out to do a study of how people who had been through successful psychoanalysis dealt with some of their everyday issues. And what he began to find was striking similarities to writings from Eastern philosophy, that people, without quite using that same word, tended to become unattached in the sense that they didn't glom onto their emotions in quite the same way that they had, didn't hold grudges quite so much, didn't get so deeply into their feelings of how somebody else needed to be showed up or, you know, carrying their injustices around. And so that what he suggested was, very strongly, was that there are kind of growth processes that take place or can take place with people in psychotherapy that may not be the same at all as what the what the therapist's formal theoretical writings indicate.
Well, you also point to the contemporary neurobiological investigations that have also converged with Buddhism that similarly have shown that the notion of self, getting attached to a notion of self, is a kind of psychological illusion, and that there is no self to be found inside the brain.
Yeah, people really have a hard time with that, but it's one of those things where I encourage people, and of course Buddhists have been saying the same thing, is take a look at those theoretical issues, but most of all, take a look at your own experience, and, you know, take a look at what you find from minute to minute. And what people can find is that they kind of let go of that concept of the self, which is so deeply ingrained in our everyday consciousness, and move into another way of kind of going about the everyday world, which is one in which, paradoxical as it might sound, your own consciousness is one in which you're just not that conscious of yourself in the process. Now, more recently, I mentioned the work of people like, I think it's pronounced Csikszentmihalyi at Chicago, who has written about the concept of flow, in which people in all kinds of different experiences, mountain climbing, kayaking, artwork, crafts, and things like that, just become completely absorbed in that experience and lose that sense of themselves as the experiencer. And so we're familiar with those kinds of experiences, or at least becoming familiar with descriptions of them, and recognize, hey, that's not total weirdness. It doesn't mean that I disappear or consciousness disappears. It just means that there are other ways of experiencing that people do all the time that just haven't been that much a part of our Western vocabulary. And that's, you know, a part of what I'm trying to do is to point out that Western vocabulary is in the process of changing. And if we kind of put those pieces together a bit more, then we begin to see whole different horizons of how we live in the world and how we feel about ourselves and what's going on every day.
I'm speaking with Walter Truitt Anderson about his book, The Next Enlightenment, Integrating East and West in a New Vision of Human Evolution. Walter's distantly a political scientist and the author of many interesting books and a journalist. I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. Now, you also point to the ways in which Darwinism and the whole idea of evolution, which you make a contrast between Eastern ideas of social change or cosmological change and our Western idea of progress, which has been influenced by Darwinism. And some people think that perhaps Darwinism shouldn't be an idea of progress at all. But anyway, tell us what you think the connection is between Darwinism and Buddhism.
Well, I'd rather say what's the disconnection, which is that I can't find in traditional Buddhist philosophy, traditional Asian philosophies, a sense of evolution as we think of it. And so I think that's something new that's coming into the world and has been coming into the world for, a bit over 150 years now with Darwinian evolution. And even more so with cosmology, which has given us now an image of an evolving universe, that is, of something that that grows and changes in ways that are describable as emergent, that is, that you can't quite predict them from the past. And I think that's new. And it doesn't, to my mind, refute the basic concepts of Buddhism about consciousness and growth and development and so forth. But once you put it into an evolutionary context, as I'm trying to do, you try to say, well, wait a minute, instead of just thinking of ego and enlightenment in terms of the lives of individual people, does it make sense to kind of think of the whole thing as an evolutionary development in which the human species necessarily developed that sense of ego out of language, out of social conditions, and is now poised to begin to move beyond that so that we can think of ego and enlightenment in a historical sense? And I don't mean to jump from that to say, oh boy, it's all going to happen day after tomorrow. But I think it's certainly reasonable to approach our vision of the development of the human species in terms that do relate to concepts of ego and development beyond that way of thinking.
In your book, The Future of the Self, you talk about how our contemporary self-concepts have become increasingly fluid. They've been challenged by social change and the multiplicity of our roles. And you're not a New Ager in the sense that you're proposing that we're all going to merge into one great planetary brain and lose our sense of identity in the you know, noetic coming together. But there is a little bit of that in there, don't you think? That as we become more fluid, things may become more interesting.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that we're looking at really major change, and I guess the place where I distinguish myself from the kind of mainstream New Age thinking is that it has had a very strong tendency to think that was just going to happen immediately, and it just had to happen immediately. And I've been hearing people say that for close on 40 years now, since I've been, you know, kind of associated with the human potential movement and stuff like that. A lot of people had just gotten such kind of grandiose ideas about how easily and quickly the human species was going to transform itself that they made a lot of, I think, fairly foolish predictions and overlooked a lot of fairly serious difficulties about how we change and how we don't change and how we resist change and how forces try to move backwards in the face of change, as we've been seeing a lot of in the last couple of years with major fundamentalist movements that are in part trying to halt what they see as a degradation of old beliefs and of values. So I do kind of simultaneously take issue with that kind of, you know, it's all happening right now grandiosity that I saw in the New Age, and at the same time I'm quite willing to believe and to predict and to be to be held responsible for saying that the human species does change, is changing, and is going to change in many ways, perhaps spectacularly in years to come. But I really don't know how long that's going to take.
Well, now, not everybody who listens to this show will be familiar with the term human potential movement. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the movements that you talk about in the book, the Erhard movement and Esalen and so forth, that really were some of the first efforts to translate Eastern philosophy and Eastern meditation practices into Western contexts?
Yeah, Esalen, for example, which I believe is just now celebrating its 40th anniversary, was a place that really started out as a kind of cross-cultural mix of bringing together people from different Eastern disciplines or who were Western interpreters of Eastern disciplines. Alan Watts, I believe, was the first person who gave talks there, and he was very much in the business of you might say, popularizing Zen for the West, and did a tremendous amount in doing that. So it was in large part what was going on in those movements of the 1960s, the human potential movement, human psychology, and the growth centers and all that stuff was a cross-fertilization of Eastern philosophies, particularly Buddhism, particularly Zen, with Western psychology, particularly the existential humanistic psychology of people like Abe Maslow and Rollo May and so forth, who came straight out of existential philosophy, particularly Rollo May.
Existentialism, tell us a little bit about the connections that you see there. I mean, existentialism, again, is one of these places where there is a moral dimension to it, but it's a much more problematic moral dimension than in Buddhism. Buddhism sees that, or argues at least, that if you overcome your the limits of yourself and you get in touch with the ways in which you can be empathetic for others, that a kind of natural morality emerges out of that. My understanding of existentialism is that it's much more about the dilemma of seeing the human condition and how difficult it would be to actually come up with a morality out of an honest appraisal of the human condition.
Yeah, I think existentialism historically now has come to be regarded as pretty bleak, but there were optimistic existentialists, and there were also there were Christian existentialists and moral existentialists, and there was that concept of authenticity, which I think is kind of the key word in terms of existential morality, which was regarded as something to be struggled for, even in the midst of what they saw as a meaninglessness. And I think you have to keep in mind the historical context of evolution, which was of existentialism, which was, you know, is largely Europeans in very tough times of the between and then during, between two world wars and during and just after one, where they'd seen, you know, the destruction of European civilization and the Holocaust and all that. And it's really hard to be chipper, you know, when you're living in the midst of that. But there are key ideas, I think, that come out of existentialism, particularly that emphasis on being with a capital B. And they kept insisting that we kind of take being for granted, and that the thing we needed to do was to somehow get deeply in touch with what an incredible thing it is that there is anything. And so many of their books had the title Being in Them, Being and Nothingness in Sartre's book, for example, Psychology of Being. And so Rollo May, taking a step beyond Freud, could say that we not only repress our sexual drives and animal nature in many ways, but we actually repress our own sense of ourselves as existing creatures, and that there is something that needs to be done and that can be aimed for in therapy, which is just to get people to kind of wake up and say, hey, I'm here, this is here, that's all, you know, this world around me is here. And that there is a kind of an experience that happens to people in which they become much more fully aware of their own existence. And in many places, the descriptions of those experiences, the aha experiences, they're generally called in psychotherapy, are very close to descriptions you find of enlightenment experiences, satori, in Buddhism and other Eastern traditions.
Now, there's a kind of existentialism also in cosmology. It's a little bit different emphasis, but the focus on the anthropic principle, you talk about how this relates also to a kind of Western Enlightenment tradition. Tell us about the various anthropic principles.
Let's see. I think I described there's kind of the weak anthropic principle, which is that it does appear that the universe is constructed in such a way that that gives rise to human life and human consciousness. And then the more kind of strong anthropic principle, which is that the universe was constructed or in such a way deliberately. I mean, it almost sounds theological when I put it this way, to give rise to consciousness. The universe has been trying in some sense to bring forth consciousness, and that human existence is an expression of that kind of universal urge, if you will. And this is where what had at first in some ways seemed like a fairly uncontroversial one begins to make hard-nosed scientists very, very nervous, because it begins to sound as if you're talking about the universe itself or cosmos or being itself as having some kind of intentionality. So it begins to sound kind of theistic and makes people very uncomfortable. But those kinds of ideas have been around in different ways for quite a long time in Whitehead's process philosophy, for example. And I think that those are a set of ideas that we're just going to need to keep wrestling with until we can find a way to be comfortable with the rather obvious fact that you and I and the universe are not inseparable entities. That in a sense it's quite rational, and in a way more rational than saying I am Walt Anderson, the writer. It is just as rational to say I am this particular manifestation of the universe and of the evolutionary process, because I'm inseparable from it.
Walt, that's been a wonderful exposition of some of the themes of this book that we've been talking about, which is The Next Enlightenment, Integrating East and West in a New Vision of Human Evolution. Walt Anderson is the author of many, many interesting books, including The Future of the Self, which explores some of the themes from this, and Evolution Isn't What It Used to Be. What's your current project, Walt?
Well, I'm trying to think about two different projects. One of them is about the development of global culture and of the development of a global culture that one could begin to talk about in the same way that we talk about the origins of the modern mind, that we could begin to talk about the origins of the global mind. And I'm kind of thinking through some concepts about that. And then the other is to try to go quite a bit farther in terms of stating some of the concepts from the Next Enlightenment really in clear and understandable and testable fashion within the context of psychology and psychotherapy.
That sounds great. We're looking forward to that.
Me too.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Check back next week for a chat with Brian Alexander, the author of Rapture, How Biotech Became the New Religion.
I think post-human has become a very juicy word for the bio-Luddites. Francis Fukuyama, for example, has a book out about our post-human future, which is a scary scenario for why we will all be obsolete. I don't think there will ever be such a thing as a post-human future, because the people who live in the future will just consider themselves the descendants of us. Whatever the technology delivers to them, whether it's bio or techno or digital or whatever it may be, they will just be a continuation of the human species. They may be different from us, they may be smarter or taller or live 500 years or whatever the case may be. They're just going to consider themselves human, and they will still be on the human quest. You know, I argue that there has always been a human quest. There will never be a finish line, and they will just be continuing down that quest. And that, I think, is what defines a human being.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.